What is up, everybody? Thank you for tuning in to episode 7 of Ant and Big Red vs. the World. I just want to apologize for missing last week. We had technical difficulties, unfortunately. But this time around, as always, I'm Big Red.
I'm Average Ant.
And we're going to put together a pretty good little show for you tonight. So on Ant and Big Red vs. the World today, we're going to talk a little bit about some holdout situations again in the NFL. Only this time, Earl Thomas has taken a dire turn. And Le'Veon Bell seems like he's coming back to the Steelers sooner than later. Then we're going to get into a little MLB playoff kind of discussion. And then lastly, we're going to wrap it up with the NBA GM survey that was recently. And we'll get into that. So without further ado, we can get us started on just a little background information on the Earl Thomas and Le'Veon Bell holdouts. So if you're a Seattle fan that's living under a rock, if you didn't know, Earl Thomas broke his leg in the fourth quarter of the Arizona Cardinals game last week. He was carted off the field and was shown flipping off the Seattle sideline, which has started a lot of controversy and has kind of shown Earl Thomas in some negative light. Maybe coincidentally, maybe not, Le'Veon Bell later in the, within a few days, released that, well, I don't know if he actually said it, but reports were out that Le'Veon Bell is going to report by the week 7 bye for the Steelers. Coincidence, maybe. We'll get into that a little more in a second. Ant, you can say your piece to get going here.
Yeah, I guess overall in both situations, it's just a fat L, honestly. I was rooting for both guys to get their money, secure the bag, get like what they deserve pretty much. But with Earl Thomas getting injured, he was definitely well on his way to getting a huge contract. I mean, he was playing arguably like best year of his career up to this point. And just to go out like that, like you were saying before we started recording, that's what Le'Veon Bell is trying to avoid, is a huge injury that can potentially alter end his career, which will probably happen to Earl Thomas since he's kind of getting up there in age, and it's a broken leg. So I guess that's a big L, man. And for Le'Veon, he's lost a ton of money, and if he comes back to the Steelers and doesn't get traded, like, then all this was pretty much for nothing, honestly. Like, as much as it sucks to say that, it's true. Like, he's going to come back week 7. That's their bye week. So he's still going to miss 2 more games, and he's losing a little more than $850,000 a game. So almost $1 million a game he's been losing. And he might not, like, get anything out of it. Like, he might have just lost however much million dollars, like around, like, $5 million.
I completely agree. In both situations, it's very disappointing. Earl, for one, I mean, obviously when a guy goes down for the season, that's unfortunate, but I mean, it's almost unreal to me when you sit there and the two situations are very similar, but very different. Earl Thomas wanted to hold out for same contract reasons that Le'Veon Bell does. Albeit Earl Thomas has been paid a little bit more in his career than Le'Veon Bell. He's actually signed a couple extensions. But Earl decided that he's going to play. He's not going to leave his teammates out to dry. He's going to be on the field whether he wants to contract dispute-wise or not. Le'Veon Bell said, no way, I'm doing this 100%. I deserve to get paid. I'm sitting out. And I mean, the really huge unfortunate thing is the whole reason Earl Thomas was holding out was for something exactly like this, so he could get security. And now he's done for the season. He's probably played his last game as a Seahawk. Sorry, Seattle fans, I'm shedding a tear for us right now. And like you said, he was having an excellent start to the season. He had 3 picks already, and through the first 3 games of the season, he was Pro Football Focus's top-rated free safety, which is, I mean, it's usually him and, like, Eric Weddle and guys like that, but, I mean, he's 29, going to be 30 by free agency. Yeah, he's getting up there in age. He's still playing great football. Safeties, unless you're Cam Chancellor, tend to age well. It's really unfortunate for Earl. If you're a Seahawks fan now, you have to kind of be like, well, I'm glad we didn't pay him. And like you said, it's going to impact him big time. It is a clean break, so it's not going to be like a lingering issue that should affect any of his ability, but he is getting older, and every year you sit out with a break or something like that, you're going to decline. He's going to be healthy by free agency, but he's definitely going to lose out on a lot of money. I mean, now it's his second major leg injury in the last 3 years. I mean, that's tough.
That is tough, especially building on like the year he was having. Just to go out like that, it sucks. What do you think about him flipping, or I guess he wasn't necessarily flipping off the Seattle bench, but flipping the bird towards that area. What do you think of that?
I think it sucks. I think that from a professional athlete standpoint, you're on a pedestal and you're supposed to be displaying like an example of greatness and of politeness and kindness and things like that. And you're setting an example for all these kids that watch these sports. And so it sucks when Earl Thomas is a great guy. I love him. I love the player. But then you're on national TV flipping off your own team. I mean, I know he's not flipping off the Seahawks, and I know he's like not flipping off Pete Carroll. And so I think it sucks that he did it. Pete Carroll even said we should give him a little slack in one of his post-game interviews. He mentioned that it's an incredibly emotional and difficult moment that it's not like a lot of people will never experience, and so they don't really understand the kind of emotions you're going through. And so that was Pete kind of defending him after him and John Schneider were probably the ones that he wanted to flip off the most. From just like a purely non-biased standpoint, it's disappointing that Earl Thomas is flipping off his own sideline on national TV. But I understand. I mean, just like we were just talking about, that's exactly what he wanted to avoid. He literally wanted to get a third extension in case something like this happens. So he's now broken his leg. He's in an air cast. He's getting carted off. He's been there before. He knows the story. He knows he's going to walk in and hear, "You're done for the season." And so it's an extremely emotional moment. And so from that standpoint, I understand where this anger and emotion comes from, but in that same breath, you're a professional athlete, supposed to be one of the best and brightest in the game. And to flip off your sideline on national TV like that is tough to defend. I mean, I will to an extent, but you're a professional athlete. You got to be on a higher pedestal.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel the opposite way. Obviously, like you said, he wasn't flipping off his teammates or any of the coaches or anything. It's more aimed at the owner and GM, whatever, higher-ups. In any other situation, him flipping off the bench is pretty much unacceptable. But in this situation where he was holding out, he wanted a bigger contract. He deserved it. But he didn't end up getting it, so he goes out there and plays anyway. Balls out. Then breaks his leg. I'd be so upset, you know? If I was Earl Thomas, I'd be flipping off the Seahawks sideline too, you know? So, I mean, given the circumstance, I think it's not necessarily okay, but I won't really get on him for doing it.
Yeah, I like I said, I completely understand. I get that it's an emotional moment, and this is the same Seahawks that Marshawn Lynch flipped off the sideline when they didn't call a run play. So, I mean, it's I mean, if you're going to do it in an organization, Seattle's the one to do it, I guess, because Pete Carroll's just like, hey, guys, if you're upset, just flip me off, you know? Like, then, you know, we'll give you the ball. But, yeah, I don't know. I agree to an extent. I understand it, and I get where it's coming from, but to me, you just can't do that. Le'Veon Bell is going to report after week 7, though. A couple interesting things about it are when he held out in week 1 against the Browns, I got some quotes here from his offensive alignment. Right guard Ramon Foster said they're tired of the antics. Center Marquise Pouncey says it's a little selfish. And the other guard, David DeCastro, says he makes us all look kind of stupid. And that was all on Le'Veon Bell after he didn't report week 1 against the Cleveland Browns. His offensive line, that in the past has expressed how much they enjoy him and love him out there, have pretty much just threw him under the bus and were like, you're really letting the team down for holding out. Now he said he's going to come back. A lot of those same guards are saying positive things and that they're like excited to get him back. Some of them are more guarded, probably the ones that said more offensive things at the beginning of the season. But Le'Veon Bell is set to come back after week 7. He's going to sign a franchise tender that'll be worth about $14.5 million. Obviously, that's going to be cut in half. Like you said, he's been losing like about almost a million a game. But he's going to be back, and I guess my question now to you kind of is, should the Steelers welcome him back, or should they be trying to trade him? I mean, at the end of the day, the issues are still the same, like you said earlier.
I feel like they should be doing both, honestly. Like, obviously, he's one of the best, if not the best overall running back in the game. So, like, I don't care what kind of issues you have or whatever. You're definitely welcoming that guy back on your team with open arms. But they definitely should still be trying to trade him. He's obviously most likely going to leave in free agency, so you might as well try to get something for him. But for the time being, why not have him on your team? Their offense is one of the worst in the league right now. They can't score. They can't do anything. So with him back on the offense, I mean, it'll help a lot turning the team around. And touching on the offensive linemen and like what they said, I think it's stupid. Le'Veon Bell wasn't the one making them look stupid. Those offensive linemen going out there and saying those things is what made them look stupid, because now they're over here saying, or at the beginning, like you said, they're saying nothing but positive things. Then he decides to hold out. Now they're bashing him. Now he's coming back and they're trying to act like they didn't say anything or whatever. Like, from my point of view, I feel like they should have been backing him up to an extent. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't really like it either if somebody of Le'Veon Bell's caliber was sitting out. But I mean, like, I would understand why. And if I wouldn't agree with it, I would I'd still support him or just not come out and say anything at all.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that's what was, like, I didn't even know about this until I was researching the Le'Veon Bell holdout yesterday, and I found some of the articles on the offensive linemen, and it's like I was just kind of like, why? You're obviously, when one of your best players sits out, your team doesn't have as good of a chance to win. And so from a pure football standpoint, yeah, that's frustrating. But I mean, for that entire offensive line, to a lot of these guys are veterans too that have signed multiple contracts, and to just sit there and say these things and completely ignore the business aspect of football. And I mean, I know when he's coming back, Marquise Pouncey specifically has said that the things said were, I mean, they're just out of frustration, and like, they love Le'Veon Bell and they're out of frustration. And so I get that, but I mean, when you got to understand that it's a business. And if you really do love Le'Veon Bell, like they all say they do after he's coming back now, you should be supporting him regardless. Le'Veon Bell was holding out in order to make a change and polarize something in the NFL and give running backs a fair shake now that we've shifted to a passing era and they're getting the short end of the stick. He's trying to set a precedent that running backs aren't just going to be tossed aside like they have in the last few years and untrusted after they play for 4 years, which is around their rookie contract, and then they get franchise tagged for a few years until they're too old to sign another extension. And that's what Le'Veon Bell's trying to stop, because he knows he's one of the best running backs in football. He deserves nearly $100 million, and a lot of that guaranteed. It's tough when your own offensive line isn't backing and supporting that. But, I mean, obviously the Steelers are going to welcome him back. I mean, he is one of the best running backs in football, if not the best. He's a dual threat. So, I mean, it's definitely going to help the Steelers when he eventually comes back, but I'm not sure how long he's going to be a Steeler or if it's actually even going to happen.
Yeah, I guess we're looking at probably a max of 8 games, he'll probably be a Steeler.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Steelers are still accepting or listening to trade offers, so who knows if he's actually going to suit up for him or not.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting week 7 bye for the Steelers.
Definitely. And so with that, we'll move on to a little bit of our MLB playoff stuff. So Ant, you can get us going if you'd like.
Yeah, so for those of you who are oblivious to baseball, the MLB postseason has just started. With the wild card games out of the way, a few of the divisional games out of the way, we'll give a little preview, some questions we have, and some comments we kind of got. So I guess my first question is, are the Boston Red Sox for real this year? As everybody who knows anything about baseball knows, the Red Sox pitching goes from elite to non-existent in the playoffs. Like, they had Rick Porcello win that Cy Young. Chris Sale may win the Cy Young this year. David Price is the previous Cy Young winner. But, they all, as a collective, all three of them have something crazy, like a 5.8, 5.9 ERA, I think it is, in the postseason.
Jeez.
And so that's just ridiculous, man. I don't know. I want to say this is the year they pull it together, but I don't think they will, honestly. I think their pitching will again fold. Their offense may still be good, but I mean, when your three best starters have a combined ERA of 6, you're not going to win any games.
No, I agree. And, Boston is probably one of the toughest teams to judge in this postseason just because they won 108 games. That is 5 games more than the defending champ Houston Astros. In a division that's arguably tougher, than the American League West, with the Yankees and Tampa Bay and the way they played in the second half, getting all the way to 90 wins. You look at Boston, and by all means, they've had good starting pitching throughout the year with Sale, and they picked up Nathan Eovaldi, and their offense is ridiculous with MVP candidate Mookie Betts. I believe that's who I picked when we had our predictions. Still standing by it, even if they choke in the playoffs. You're right. Every year Boston gets in, it seems like they're either on a hot streak and they're coming in, or they're taking that number one seed. And then whatever happens, last year was a perfect example. They come in and just get bodied. And their pitching falls apart, like you said. Chris Sale doesn't seem like a very good postseason pitcher. And on top of that, you got guys like JD Martinez that struggle in the playoffs. And, I mean, yeah, he had a fantastic year, so maybe he's just going to carry it over. But when you're facing elite pitching on almost every single team that you face in the playoffs, with generally having elite bullpens, too, in the American League, you can't slack off at all. You have to be better. You have to be better than you were in the regular season. And teams that can do that are the ones that are going to move on, and I'm not sure that the Red Sox can. I honestly don't think they are. 108 wins or not, I think that the Red Sox are once again going to fall either this round or in the ALCS. But I don't see the Red Sox going to the World Series this year.
Yeah, me neither. I could see them squeaking by New York, but I don't think they'll, like you said, they're definitely not making the World Series.
Yeah, and just from like a rivalry standpoint, yeah, maybe they're going to just ball out and play all they have against the Yankees. It's going to be an epic series. I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch, but beyond that, I mean, beyond like a heartfelt win for Boston over the the Empire Yankees, I think part of it is because the American League is just so loaded, but I don't think they'll get past the Astros, and if the Indians beat the Astros, I quite frankly don't think they'll beat the Indians.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I guess the second little comment I have about the postseason so far is the Brewers actually look like they can contend. I guess I haven't really put much respect on the Brewers this season in general, because like, no, they just seem like a regular season team to me. You know, that always happens. There's one team that surprises everybody, is really good in the regular season, and then when it comes to big boy baseball, they get a reality check.
But, Oakland Athletics.
But no, the Brewers actually, their lineup 1 through 8, I guess, since they're in the NL, is pretty solid. Their starters are pretty solid. Their bullpen is really good. They're just all overall a team that really has no holes. So I can definitely see them making a deep run, maybe making it to the World Series. I'm not 100% sure on that, but the NL is definitely wide open. There's no team that's above everybody else like there is in the AL with like the Astros, I guess I would say, even though they're not as far above everybody else as they were last year, but there's no team like that in the NL, so it's wide open. There's a realistic chance for every team to make it to the World Series in the NL, so I feel like it's definitely a year that the Brewers can pull through and make some noise.
Oh no, I 100% agree. The Brew Crew is legit. When you talk about the wide open NL race, that's true as well. I mean, the Braves won their division with 90 wins. The Dodgers and Rockies tied around like 91 wins, and even Milwaukee tied with Chicago for the division, and then won their play-in and sent the Cubs to the wild card where they lost. But it's wide open. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, we talked about this when we did our preview awards. There's like a bit of parity in the NL, and it's not like these teams are bad. I mean, the Dodgers are absolutely loaded with talent. The Cubs won the World Series a couple years ago, and they have basically that same core. But I mean, you look at the acquisitions that Milwaukee had in the offseason, Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich. I mean, Yelich is having an MVP season. I mean, he came out of nowhere. We didn't even talk about him.
Yeah.
And now the dude almost won the Triple Crown. Like, that's insane. But, I mean, you look at that roster with Cain and Yelich, those are the acquisitions. You still have Ryan Braun. Homegrown Jesus Aguilar has been a beast. Travis Shaw has come out of nowhere to have a rebirth of his career. They traded for Mike Moustakas, Orlando Arcia at shortstop. And you talked about their bullpen with Josh Hader, who has been electric all year. They have Joaquin Soria and Corey Knebel, a nasty 97 with sink. I mean, I think the Brewers were kind of a team that underperformed in the regular season, honestly. I feel like the Brewers could have easily been a 100-win team, but they kind of just floated around like good, not great. And then whether it was Christian Yelich getting hot or not, I don't know, but something clicked for them, and they've turned into just, I'm not a juggernaut, obviously, but they've turned into a really solid team that I think could very easily run the NL. I think their only competition, in my opinion, is the Dodgers. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see the Dodgers beat them, but I think the Brewers are definitely going to the NLCS, and they're going to play the Dodgers. And it's going to come down to whether or not LA can put their talent together, because they're loaded too. They got Machado during the season, for me, though, it's just like the Dodgers always have a ton of talent but never seem to put it together. And even last year when they did, and they were in the World Series, they were geared up to win, they still lost. And so I almost have like a reverse Red Sox, not reverse Red Sox, like a Red Sox effect that the Dodgers have, is they play great during the regular season and just can't get it done in the playoffs. And so with a hot, red-hot Brewers team with a ton of talent, I think that's the biggest thing the Dodgers need to worry about, and I'm not sure if they can handle him.
Yeah, the biggest standout thing to me about the Brewers is definitely their bullpen, and specifically John Hader. He reminds me a lot of Andrew Miller on the Indians a couple years ago, when he pretty much, any time he came to the game, he just shut it down. He was an elite reliever. Nobody could touch him, and I feel like John Hader can definitely fill that role. He had something like, I think it was like 15.3 Ks per nine this year, which set MLB record, which is ridiculous. And watching the first game between the Rockies and Brewers, like the Rocky hitters had no chance against him when he was in the game. I feel like they could definitely ride him in later innings and win some close games because of him.
Yeah, and I mean, Hader's arrival comes after they got Corey Knebel out of nowhere to be one of the better closers in baseball in the second half last year when they were solid. To a back end of Hader and Knebel, and they also have Joaquin Soria, who has plenty of closing experience, that bullpen is one of the best in baseball, purely because you have two just... If there's a bullpen superstar, the Brewers are starting to grow and get two of them right there before our eyes in Knebel and Hader. I guess bold prediction, I got to go Brew Crew out of the NL. I mean, I like the Dodgers, and I mean, I think they've... I mean, they're kind of like the Yankees of the NL, but I mean, they deserve to win as well, but I think it's going to be the Brewers as hot as they are.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Dodgers definitely got the talent. Like you said, NL, they're the Yankees and the Red Sox of the NL. So.
Yeah.
I guess my last little question, it's less in depth, more of a fun type thing, is are the Astros going to repeat? Right now, there isn't, even though the AL is a lot stronger than the NL, and they have more juggernaut teams, I guess. The World Series is still pretty much wide open. The World Series isn't really like the finals or in the NFL with the Super Bowl. Like, any team in the playoffs can make a deep run anytime out of nowhere. So, with the open field, I guess I'd have to go with Astros to repeat, honestly. Their pitching has taken, at least their starters anyway, have taken a step up from last year. So I think that's the biggest difference. Carlos Correa isn't having the best year. He definitely took a step down. But Alex Bregman took a huge step up. So that pretty much cancels out, if not adds on to what they had last year. So I guess I'd have to go Astros repeat.
Yeah, and I mean, I quite honestly, I mean, you can ask Marcus, who was on a couple weeks ago. We were talking about it the other day at practice. And I even said that too. He wasn't quite as on board with me. But I mean, it's the American League is muddled as well, just like the National League, but in a different way. The American League is muddled with three or four teams that are legit, arguably, you could say, maybe the best team in baseball when they're playing well. You could say that about the Astros defending world champs. Their starting pitching staff was good last year when they got Verlander. They loaded up with Gerrit Cole, who had the best year of his career. Alex Bregman had the best year of his career, and he was already a postseason hero, so I can't even imagine what he's going to do this postseason. And at the Astros' biggest weak point is their bullpen. And I mean, it was like that last year as well. But I mean, last year was a little nerve-wracking with Ken Giles and his struggles. But I mean, I think in this kind of muddled juggernaut league in the American League, with a great team in Boston, a great team in Cleveland, a great team in New York, when it comes down to who's going to come out, the Astros players and staff has the most experience. They're the only group that's won the World Series in the last few years.
However many years. Yeah.
Because the Indians lost. Boston hasn't been there in a while. New York hasn't been there in a while either. And so it's in this playoff grouping, the Astros are defending world champs, bringing back their core from last year and more. Yes, the talent they're facing is better, and the Yankees have a little more playoff experience, but I mean, I think for me, it's just a really difficult choice in general because of how good all these teams in the American League are, but I'm going to be on board with you. I'm going to say the Astros repeat. Dark horse, if anybody's going to change it, it's going to be Cleveland in the first round, and then I would change my pick to Cleveland, because in my mind, when you beat the best team, record aside, Boston, when you beat the best team, then you're in really good shape, and I think Cleveland would ride that momentum, especially with the bullpen and starting pitching they have. But until that happens, it's Astros for me too.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so that was a good little piece there, and thanks for staying on, guys. Last little piece we're going to get into here is the NBA GM survey. Just released a couple days ago. So, Ant, if you want to touch on a couple pieces, we can get into just some of the interesting things about the survey and what caught our eye.
Yeah, so I guess there was only really two things that really stood out to me. One being Karl-Anthony Towns not being top six for the who would you sign to start a franchise today when he was the number one pick last year. I think that's crazy how much things can change in a year, you know what I'm saying? He's looked at as undoubtedly going to be the best player in the league someday, but now it's definitely a lot more questionable considering he's only good on one side of the ball, and all the players chosen besides Steph Curry, I think, were at least decent on both sides of the ball. Like, I'd say all of them were elite besides probably LeBron. But even then, LeBron's still, when he wants, when he can be one of the better defenders in the league. But at this point of his career, he's just not really trying as hard in the defensive end, which is, I mean, I guess I'm somewhat okay with it, I guess. But anyway, the second thing that stood out to me was Brad Stevens overthrowing Greg Popovich as being voted the best coach in the league. I think last year, Greg Popovich won it with like an 83% vote, which is crazy how quick Brad Stevens burst on the scene. I mean, he deserves it. I mean, I don't know if I would say he's the best coach in the league, but him and Greg Popovich are definitely one and two. That can't really be argued. The way he coached the Celtics, especially last year, before they signed Kyrie and Gordon Hayward, even though they were both out for a majority of the season. His defensive schemes and all that, getting the most out of every player on the roster, is definitely Greg Popovich-esque. And I guess I can see why the GMs went with him instead of Pop.
Well, I mean, I think I would argue it's kind of like a changing of the guard. I mean, it's definitely shocking to see Pop down from that pedestal. I mean, he's been there like for a long, long time. The Spurs have been really good. Popovich has arguably the greatest coach of all time. And so, I mean, whenever anyone upends that in any kind of survey or question, I mean, it's obviously surprising, but I mean, the Spurs are not going to be as good this year. DeMar DeRozan or not, you lost Kawhi Leonard, you're losing Danny Green. You're losing two elite perimeter defenders, and Kawhi Leonard at least was an efficient scorer when he actually wanted to play for San Antonio. But the Spurs aren't going to be as good, and I think that the GMs are kind of recognizing that, and they're now going to see a Pop era without the big three. And I mean, I don't think anybody's disrespecting his coaching ability at all. I think it more stems from kind of like you were saying of how excellent Brad Stevens is at getting the most out of his players on the defensive end, at the very least. I mean, even when now they're loaded with talent and superstars, but I mean, even before they brought in Kyrie and Gordon Hayward, their defense was always legit. And I mean, part of that's because they had a lot of rangy athletic wings with like Avery Bradley and Jaylen Brown, but part of it's Brad Stevens and creating rotations and scheme adjustments that were legit. And so I don't think that Brad Stevens is a better coach than Greg Popovich, but I think for the purposes of this survey, it makes sense that Brad Stevens is taking over, because he's going to have the, barring more catastrophic injuries, the Boston Celtics are going to have the best record in the East. And so, I mean, I agree with it, even though it is weird to see Pop fall.
Yeah, I guess where I'd have to disagree is kind of the Spurs are going to be better this year than they were last year. They didn't have Kawhi at all last year. I mean, I think he played like 9 games. So from going from having no superstar player to having DeMar DeRozan is definitely a huge upgrade. And DeMar DeRozan under Pop, I feel like, is definitely going to hone his skill set, I guess I would say, and become the best player he could possibly be, which is, I mean, obviously he's not he will never be a top 5, top 10 player, but he's definitely a superstar. So, I mean, going from having no superstar to having one is definitely an upgrade. I mean, last year, where they didn't have a superstar, they still almost won 50 games. A lot of that credit does go to Pop because of how great of a coach he is. And I guess LaMarcus Aldridge did step up a little bit, but I guess that would that'd have to be my little disagreement.
I agree with that. I agree with that. DeMar DeRozan, yes, they will be better because they have DeMar DeRozan. Only because they did not have Kawhi Leonard for the better part of 2 seasons. I should rephrase my fall statement. I don't think the Spurs are going to be bad, and like you said, if they're good, it's going to be mostly because Pop is a great coach and now has another star that he can kind of groom. DeMar DeRozan's coming off his best, most efficient year, by the way. So there is positive signs there. But I meant more like, I still think, even though they are going to be better, I still think the Spurs are going to fall out of the upper echelon. I think the top tier, obviously, in the West is Houston, Golden State, and it was San Antonio, but I mean, I don't know if I can say that anymore. I think Oklahoma City is going to be a really good defensive team. I think the Utah Jazz are going to be really good again. The West is always loaded and good, and now LeBron's on the Lakers. So I think it's going to be tough for the Spurs to scratch and claw into a top 4 seed, and I don't know if I see him doing it, honestly.
Yeah, top 4 seed, maybe not, but they're definitely still a lock for the playoffs.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They're not going to fall that far. I would agree with that. But that's what I'm saying, is Pop's been like a lock for the upper echelon, and so it's not... he's just not anymore. So that's where I understand where the Brad Stevens vote is coming from, I guess.
Yeah, I get you. I understand that. The Celtics are top of the East, and Spurs are falling out of the top of the West. They still could get there, though. I can see them getting a 4 seed, though.
I mean, you can't rule anything out where Pop. I mean, that's why. That's why he's on the list every year, because whenever you think the Spurs are stars are aging or they're done, they show up and ball out. So I guess one interesting thing for me on the GM survey, so the Warriors were 87% favorites to repeat among the GMs, 7% for Boston and 7% for Houston. Which this is what's kind of humorous to me. So you can't vote for your own team or your own personnel or your own players or anything like that. So if you're Steve Kerr and you're sitting there looking at this GM, or not Steve Kerr, whoever the Warriors GM is, if you're sitting there and looking at this as the owner of the Warriors with the big five, who do you vote for? Do you vote for Houston? Do you, like, I mean, obviously some one person voted for Houston and one person voted for Boston. Everybody else voted for the Warriors. So, A, I want to know who the other person not voting for the Warriors is, and B, as the Golden State GM, he's obviously one of the people that didn't vote for Golden State, so I just think it's funny. Like, in a scenario like this, where obviously anything can happen, and maybe this is the year the Warriors are finally snake-bitten and actually get some injuries. With the exception of 2015 and Steph Curry's knee, he still played. Doesn't really count, in my opinion.
Yeah, it doesn't count, for sure.
Yeah, but I don't know. You're sitting there as the GM of the Warriors. On all metrics by paper, they were the best team in the NBA. Then they added one of the best centers in the NBA. And now you're supposed to sit there and pick a team that you think is going to beat you. I just think that's funny. I imagine that had to be Houston that they picked just because they almost beat him last year. He's probably sitting there like, yeah, I mean, it's not going to happen, but I guess the Rockets maybe.
No, he probably didn't even answer that question. Like, he probably just circled something just real quick.
Just curved it. It was like, yeah, I don't need to worry about that. My team's going to the finals again. Jokes aside there, one actual interesting thing I wanted to talk about was, so LeBron, once again, it was ranked top in a billion categories, best small forward, best at forcing coaches to make adjustments, best passer, best leader, most versatile, best basketball IQ. So, I mean, that's typical LeBron of the guy you view as the best player in the world every year. But one thing that I found interesting, and obviously part of its age and measured decline, I guess, even though he hasn't really started declining, and I don't know when that freak of an athlete is going to, but with the exception of basketball IQ, LeBron's kind of stranglehold on all of these voting positions has kind of dropped. His percentages compared to last year are lower on a lot of these, including small forward, where LeBron's at 57% and Kevin Durant's at 40%, whereas LeBron was near around 70% last year.
Yeah, small forward, I guess LeBron was at 61, so he did drop off, but not that much, I guess, and it's more of we've seen what Kevin Durant does in the finals when guarded or being avoided by LeBron James, because LeBron does tend to back off, switch on picks really easily and unnecessarily. So I guess we've seen a lot of that. So I'm honestly a little surprised KD isn't a little higher and it's not a little more even. But other than that, LeBron is pretty much top five or top six, however many people they choose for these awards, and all of them he can be. that's pretty ridiculous. His percentages are definitely going down because, like, although his numbers say otherwise, he is declining. Like, his numbers are definitely a little inflated. They don't really tell the whole story. He is on his decline. He's been on his decline for a little bit now. Athletic decline anyway, and like, this is a little going off on a tangent a little bit, but I would definitely take, although Miami LeBron didn't have the stats, and this year's LeBron put up better stats than any Miami or LeBron did. I'm definitely taking 13 LeBron as the best LeBron of all time. But other than that, yeah, it's crazy how much, how many of these questions that LeBron either was the number one or was top five.
he's
ridiculous.
Painted all over the survey, and that speaks to his ability. I mean, part of the decline too that I think is in voting percentage, not like his actual skillful athletic decline, is not only is he getting older, but the league is influxing a massive amount of talent right now. I mean, with Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, Giannis, KD's still in his prime, Anthony Davis is still in his prime, and young. And so it's, yes, LeBron, I mean, as LeBron gets older, the new era of basketball superstars are moving in, and that's going to continue to just chunk and chip away at LeBron's stranglehold on the best player on the planet. And one of these days, he's not going to be sitting in the finals every single year. And this is probably the year it's going to happen as he's joining, like, a rebuilding Lakers team.
Yeah. I guess something else that, isn't it, now that you mentioned the best, like, his stranglehold on the best player in the game, something that really stood out to me was Anthony Davis was voted the best power forward in the league and the best center in the league.
Noah.
Yeah, I think that's crazy. I guess this is going to be a Carl Anthony Towns Hayden sesh, but he dropped down to, he's at number three when he was number one last year at 28%. AD is at 40% for best center of the league. Joel Embiid surpassed Carl Anthony Towns too. And if DeMarcus Cousins didn't tear his Achilles, I would assume he'd be above Carl Anthony Towns at number three too. Carl Anthony Towns Hayden sesh real quick.
I mean, it's warranted, though. Like, yeah. He's horrible at defense. It sucks.
Yeah, and then the best power forward, so goes AD, LeBron, KD, and Giannis, which is, that's kind of funny to me, since LeBron, KD, and Giannis are small forwards as of last year. LeBron may be moving to power forward this year, but, I think that's funny that there really is no, besides AD, there's really no, like, elite power forwards. And AD being voted best at two positions is, like, eye-opening, I guess. Like, that man's a beast. He's just, I would argue that he's just now entering his prime. He's still only, what, like, 25, I think? 25, 26? He's just now entering his prime. His prime will probably last till he's about 30, 31, 32. So I'm excited to see what he does building. At least I'm excited to see what he does this season and building on that and in the future what he does.
Yeah, I mean it's funny. It's funny that AD's leading power forwards and centers. And I also kind of agree. Like when you think about power forwards in the league, who comes to your mind besides like Anthony Davis?
Maybe Kristaps, but
yeah, Kristaps, I guess. But Kristaps should be a center if he wasn't so lanky.
Yeah.
Paul Millsap, dude's older now.
LaMarcus Aldridge is number five on here, but
yeah, he's another old dude. He's another guy that's aging, and his prime's behind him. And I think this is kind of again going off a little bit of the actual survey, but the NBA. Obviously, playstyle-wise is shifting away from power forwards in the front court being a focal point. So unless you're like a Joel Embiid, this will be a nice thing about Karl Anthony Towns, where you can shoot the basketball and guard the perimeter a little bit, or at least have the athleticism to do so, because we all know Karl Anthony Towns hasn't. If you're not one of those guys who... Power forward used to be a bruiser position. You didn't need to shoot the ball. You just needed to be able to guard centers and small forwards interior in the interior. And so now, I mean, it's like But if you could shoot at power forward, why you're almost like a small forward. So why aren't you a small forward? And if you're big enough and you can shoot, then why not make like a legit hybrid center? And so I mean, just in league wide in general, there's a lack of talent at power forward, unless you're a polarizing player like Anthony Davis. And I think that just kind of goes in line with the direction NBA offensive and schemes are going.
Yeah, for sure. Building off that tangent, I guess, like you're getting at, NBA is definitely moving towards more of a positionless game. Like Brad Stevens, his whole coaching scheme is there's guards, wings, and a big man. And that's pretty much almost where our entire league is at, with a few exceptions like Zach Randolph, LaMarcus Aldridge, traditional centers and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's definitely where we're getting to, and that's why I think there's a lack of talent at power forward, because like you either split off into the wing or a big man. So you either have the ability to shoot and handle like a guard, so you play more small forward, or you can't do any of that and you're center. So that's why I guess I don't think there's a lack of talent at the power forward.
100%. I mean, 100% agreement on that. But I mean, that's a big debate we can get into another time. But for now, got a shout out for my guy Marcus, who was on a couple weeks ago. He did predict the A's would lose in the wild card, but all you had to do is look at any of the last times the A's have been in the playoffs to think of that. You could watch Moneyball and see how much they lose in the playoffs. Still hitting on the A's, and I will always, as they strip the Mariners of the playoffs every year. But yeah, thanks for tuning in, guys.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. Again, apologies for missing out last week. We did have some technical difficulties on both ends. It was kind of crazy, but we made our adjustments. So we're glad to be back, and we'll see you next week.